This time, a new weekly constitutional. The Second Amendment hasn't been in front of the Supreme Court for quite some time, but that may soon change. So it's time for an update. Here's Steve Holbrook of the Independent Institute.
I don't want to predict the outcome of any specific case, but I do think that this right to bear arms, because of the language of the Second Amendment, that I don't see how you can restrict that to a few people that the government selects to exercise that right.
And here's Robert Spitzer of the State University of New York at Cortland.
You might have rulings that are more broadly accepting of limitations, of restrictions, and that would seem to me to be a more likely long-term prospect.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about guns and stuff.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
In 2008, in the landmark case of District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court of the United States held that our national government has to respect an individual right to keep and bear arms pursuant to the Second Amendment. 2 years later, in the case of McDonald versus Chicago, they said the same thing about state governments. They also have to respect our right, our individual right, to keep and bear arms. But that was almost 10 years ago, and since that time, the Supreme Court has been completely silent on the Second Amendment. That's not because there haven't been any attempts to get cases in front of the Supreme Court. There have been many. But the court, which has discretion in most circumstances as to whether it's going to hear a particular case, has declined every Second Amendment case until January of this year, of 2019, when it accepted a case from New York City that challenges a New York City statute that restricts the ability of handgun owners to transport their weapons. That case is going to be heard by an emerging conservative majority with new justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. And many people are very interested in what's going to happen. That's why the law review at my law school, the Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee, recently decided to have a symposium on the Second Amendment, to which a number of prominent Second Amendment scholars were invited. Today, we're going to hear from two of them. Later on, we'll hear from Robert Spitzer, a professor at the State University of New York at Cortland, who's been thinking and writing about the Second Amendment for years. But first, we'll hear from Steve Holbrook of the Independent Institute.
I'm an attorney. I've been practicing for 40 years. I've focused on constitutional law issues. I've had the opportunity, privilege of arguing three cases in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, what were those cases?
Which I won.
You batting 1,000 in the U.S.
Right.
Supreme. I have never met anybody who's batting 1,000.
You know, two of them were 5-4, and then my last one was 9-0. It was incredible.
You're getting better and better.
The first one was a technical classification issue about what a firearm was. The defendant was the United States, but it was like the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And we got a court ruling that it was not a restricted firearm. The second case is the one that's in all the law books. It's Prince versus United States. That's Sheriff Jay Prince, who challenged the Brady Act provision that attempted to usurp states to do federal bidding. In other words, Congress said, you have to go out and do background checks on handgun purchasers, but the sheriff's localities, they don't work for the federal government. There was a permanent provision to that law where the federal Bureau of Alcohol, FBI rather, does those background checks, and we're fine with that, and that's the way it is now. But basically, the Supreme Court opinion by Justice Scalia said that that the states cannot be conscripted by the federal government to do federal functions that are not within the constitutional purview.
And I'm going to interrupt you here, Steve, and tell you what an honor it is to speak to the guy who won that case, because I teach that every year.
Yeah.
In constitutional law, it involves the 10th Amendment. And as you know, it gave rise to an entire doctrine, anti-commandeering. The federal government cannot commandeer state officials and have them do the federal government's bidding. In fact, isn't there language in Prince that says that state officials appear nowhere on any federal employment chart?
Right. That shows you how wide the constitutional issue was. It wasn't just the 10th Amendment. It was also like the commerce power, whether there's some kind of authority to conscript them for that.
Right.
But also the principle that the executive branch can hire and fire people. And of course, and that makes them responsible. In other words, there's somebody to answer to for what you do. But the local police and sheriffs, they don't work for the federal government. So no matter what they would do, they could abuse that power and they couldn't be disciplined or otherwise let go. So
it's a huge issue.
And the case has something for everybody. It's not a right or left issue. And in fact, you'll find every time Congress tries to get out of line and take on these powers that where they order the states and localities around, it can be good or bad depending on what issue it is for you and your politics.
That's the funniest thing about states' rights, so-called. I prefer to call it state power, but that's a quibble. But the so-called states' rights issue is frequently identified with people on the political right. But as you just alluded to, it can also impact people on the political left. If California wants to do something and the feds try to interfere with what California is doing, then they might run straight into this exact problem that you had in the Prince case.
I mean, this whole thing about sanctuary cities,
yes,
I'm not sure that it's permissible to have them. There's other issues, but certainly the federal government cannot tell the states to dictate to them what they do with prisoners.
They can't, or what their cops do on the state level.
Right. And by the way, I don't think it's just a quibble. It's not a state's right. It's a state power.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I've always insisted on that language.
But we had to litigate that, like in the on the Second Amendment issue, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. It's not the power of a state to maintain a militia, and that perverts the language. It's the same as the right of the people to assemble or to be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures. So.
Okay, this is really cool, and that gets to what you're going to be talking about tomorrow. But I want to hear what the third case was in the Supreme Court that you argued that you won 9-0, and then we'll return to the Second Amendment.
Well, it was a right to jury trial issue, Castillo versus United States, 2000. Mm-hmm. It arose out of the Waco tragedy in the early 90s when you had the interaction between the so-called Branch Davidians and the ATF and the mm-hmm. FBI, and you had, like, I don't know, 75 civilians being killed, four ATF agents. It was a real horror show. But the issue came down to the people who survived were indicted for a conspiracy to commit murder. The jury didn't see it that way. They saw it overreach by the government, but they did convict them of using firearms in a federal crime of violence, which would normally get you a 5-year sentence. And the judge at sentencing made up a doctrine where he can make all these findings and give them 30 years instead of 5 years. And the jury never heard anything about that. So that really was, in a nutshell, what the case was about. When you charge somebody with a crime, it's got to be in the indictment. They got to tell you what it's all about. And the jury's got to find you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't want judges making stuff up at sentencing that the jury's never heard anything about. And because there's been a tendency of state and federal governments to legislate to try to give powers to sentencing judges, and it goes too far sometimes. And so we had a 9-0 win on that. Justice Breyer wrote the opinion. It was so cool. I didn't know if I had 5 or 4 on my side, and when he started speaking in the oral argument, I mean, he just picked up my football and ran right to my goal. I mean,
isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Isn't it? In an oral argument, and you have a judge listen to something you say, and then he turns to your opponent and says, "Yeah, what about what he said?"
Right, yeah.
That had to be a great moment.
Yes.
Well, congratulations. I strongly recommend, Steve, that you never, ever take another Supreme Court case, because it would be a pity to blow that batting average.
Well, I have to relate two more cases I was involved in. I didn't argue the cases, uh-huh. but I was deeply involved. One was District of Columbia versus Heller.
That's the what you've done. Oh, wow. And that's going to take us into the Second Amendment. That's the granddaddy case.
Yeah.
What did you do in Heller?
I had the honor of representing a majority of members of Congress in an amicus friend of the court brief.
Right.
And it was the most members of Congress who've ever signed on a brief. It was both Republicans and Democrats. It was bipartisan. And we prevailed in that case. And then in the follow-up case, McDonald versus Chicago,
right.
Besides McDonald, the National Rifle Association was a party.
Finally.
And I wrote major portions of the brief in that case, and both those cases were wins for our side. So, yeah,
but,
you know,
in the thick of the Second Amendment stuff then too.
Oh yeah, and the funny thing is, it's harder to win cases in the courts below. You know, my batting record in the courts of appeals, I've argued in most circuits, and it's nowhere near like in the Supreme Court. But
hey, but, if you got to win, you want to win the last round.
You know, but one more case I have to tell you about. After the Heller case, the same plaintiff I represented in the D.C. Circuit in a case came to be known as Heller 2. And we challenged some very onerous restrictions that D.C. enacted after the Supreme Court decided the handgun ban against them. And it was like D.C.'s attitude is, we want to get revenge because we lost our case, so we're going to make it harder for gun owners to own guns in D.C. than ever before. And we challenged two of those major provisions, a ban on certain semi-automatic rifles and on the registration system. And we lost the case 2-1, but guess who was the judge who dissented? Mm-hmm. It was now Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
Oh, my, my.
So he's on the Supremes now.
So you were playing the long game there.
Well, so... I never thought much about it. I thought, okay, I lost another case. But then when he gets elevated to the Supreme Court, I'm thinking, yes.
Well, then maybe you should take a case now that he's on the court. Well, obviously, people have strong feelings on both sides of the gun control or gun rights issue, and also about D.C. versus Heller. But every year when I teach that case, I will say you've got to admire the wisdom of the plaintiff's lawyers in picking Dick Heller, because he's the perfect, perfect plaintiff. He is a law-abiding citizen who was denied the right to buy a gun in the District of Columbia. I'm simplifying things here a bit. And in his day job, he is a federal police official who, of course, can carry a handgun, is required to carry a handgun, and his job, that's the best part, is to protect federal judges.
That's right. That's right.
Oftentimes cases suffer from the fact that their plaintiffs do not have clean hands and maybe not the best reputations. That's particularly true in, you know, criminal cases. But man, oh man, did you guys pick a great plaintiff. Did you have anything to do with picking Dick Heller?
No, because, see, I was not one of the attorneys that represented the plaintiffs in that case, although I represented them late in the later cases.
Okay.
But in that case, it was another attorney, and my role in that case was just a friend of the court brief by members of Congress.
So you came in kind of late on that one.
I had litigated the same issue, and it turned out differently before that case. But like you say, what's so ironic about that case is he was fully trusted to protect federal judges with a gun, with a handgun, when he was on duty, and when he went home, he was not trusted with having a handgun to protect himself in his own home.
That's just a compelling juxtaposition.
Yes, right.
It really and truly is. Okay, we finally get to the Second Amendment then. Okay, and the subject of your discussion tomorrow. And let's return to that concept of states' rights versus state power and how it applies in the Second Amendment context, because I think you've got an argument that I hadn't really thought about much. But let me just say why I call it that way. You know, governments have powers. Governments do not generally have rights. A right, as far as the Supreme Court typically treats them, a constitutional right, is the ability to stop government from doing something. So an individual will have a right. Governments have powers, and that's why I like to phrase it that way. And I realize it's not as simple as that, that the court itself will use the phrase states' rights occasionally. Why do you like to say power rather than rights when it comes to states?
Well, for individual liberties, those have always been considered rights. Things that governments do are powers. As I mentioned before, that term right of the people appears in three places in the Bill of Rights: right of the people peaceably to assemble, right of the people to be secure in their persons, papers, houses, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures, and of course, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And another important distinction, though, is that the people have some powers. And remember, the Tenth Amendment refers to the powers not delegated to the federal government or reserved to the states,
respectively, or to the people.
To the
right.
People. What are those powers? Well, one would be suffrage. You get to vote. You vote them out. You know. Another one is to serve on juries. That's a power. That's a governmental power where you have citizens coming in to participate in the criminal justice system and the civil justice system. And also, you could consider the right to keep and bear arms to the extent that it allows the people to have a form of protection from tyranny that was the base reason why the founders wanted to focus on a militia system instead of a standing army. Participation in the militia could be considered a power, because there you have ordinary people coming together as opposed
to form a military force.
Instead of a mercenary army where you could have, like in ancient Rome, the big shot, the emperor, has his Praetorian Guard. He's got these people who answer only to him.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about the Second Amendment, a subject the Supreme Court may soon take up again. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with our first guest, Steve Holbrook of the Independent Institute, and then we'll speak to Robert Spitzer of the State University of New York at Cortland. Stick around. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about guns and stuff, that old Second Amendment that the Supreme Court has been so reticent about since the last time it took up a case in 2010. That may soon change. So the law review at my law school, the Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee, recently had a symposium to which it invited several scholars, and today we're talking to two of them. Right now we're talking to Steve Holbrook of the Independent Institute, and he's telling us all about the relationship between the Second Amendment and standing armies and all sorts of interesting stuff.
Citizens, for the most part, have rights, but as you pointed out, occasionally they are exercising governmental powers.
That's right.
When they exercise the right to vote, and certainly when they exercise the right to have a militia. So what are you going to tell us tomorrow? Well, you're here, of course, to participate in a great big symposium with you and lots of other brainy guys, constitutional scholars, Second Amendment scholars, lawyers such as yourself. You're here to participate in this. What is the message that you're going to share with all of the assembled people? And by the way, we've got a full house.
Oh, that's super. I got interested in the subject when I was an undergraduate. And at this point, I've published 9 books. Look at my website. It's called stephenholbrook.com, StephenHalbrook.com.
Right, Halbrook, not Holbrook.
Okay. Well, they pronounce it both ways, and mm-hmm. So I'm lenient on that. The Founder's Second Amendment is one of my books that was cited by the Supreme Court, and another one called Freedmen, the 14th Amendment and the Right to Bear Arms. It was about the freed slaves being subjected to the so-called black codes. They couldn't own guns after the Civil War, even when slavery was ended. And that was an important issue involving why the 14th Amendment got adopted, so that the Bill of Rights provisions would apply to the states. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of the books. It's really cool when the Supreme Court cites your books, by the way.
I would think
it really
very
makes
cool.
It worthwhile.
I bet it would be.
Yeah.
Almost as good as winning your case.
That's right. So, but frankly, the funny thing is, the book I wrote on the 14th Amendment, I had lost a case in the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit about California had a law where they banned a lot of rifles. And they said, well, the Second Amendment doesn't apply to the states. And I was so determined after that, that my book on Freedmen and the 14th Amendment was partly inspired by that loss in that court. And then it ends up, that's the view that prevails in the McDonald decision by the U.S. Supreme Court.
A moment of explanation. This is a somewhat obscure topic in constitutional law called incorporation, and I'll have to explain. If you understand that individuals have rights and that governments have powers, and that an individual right protects you against the action of a government, then you'll realize that the D.C. versus Heller decision, which came out of a federal District of Columbia, is a decision that protects an individual against a national law, a federal law that would somehow restrict that individual's right to keep and bear arms. But there was an additional step that needed to be taken to take that right, now that it was recognized by the Supreme Court, and apply it, the phrase is, as against the states, to incorporate it in the Bill of Rights as against the states. And so you participated in both phases of that.
Right. Most people probably think that the Bill of Rights has always applied against the states. You know, the funny thing is, the First Amendment starts by saying Congress shall make no law. And then it goes on to talk about freedom of religion and speech and all of that. It doesn't mention the states at all.
Right.
Second Amendment's broader. It says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, there, in the early republic, there were some courts who said that did apply to states.
Because it used the passive voice, shall not
right.
be infringed.
Right, and it was a general statement. It didn't say anything about Congress. But the Supreme Court cleared all this up in the 20th century, where first they said it, the Bill of Rights applies to the states regarding the First Amendment rights, and then it was pretty late in
coming. Long before that, in the early 19th century, in the case of Barron versus Baltimore, that's when they said, no, the Bill of Rights does not apply to the states.
Right.
And we did a two-part episode on Barron versus Baltimore with a good friend of mine from the University of Tennessee. It was a very popular episode, so if people want to listen to it, they can go to our podcast site or iTunes or Spotify and simply look up Barron versus Baltimore, B-A-R-R-O-N. That was the first interpretation, but then as you were just about to explain, it was after the passage of the 14th Amendment, which definitely applied to state governments. Mm-hmm. And after the promulgation of the Due Process Clause, which applies to states, the Supreme Court then gradually, bit by bit, started considering individual amendments and then either applying them or not to the states. And we're at the point now, the last big one was the Second Amendment. And now it's only a couple of provisions, I think, involving the size of grand juries.
The Indictment Clause.
Right.
A case is up there now on proportionality under the Eighth Amendment. And also civil juries under the Seventh Amendment. That
right.
does not apply to the states. So.
But those are just relatively, I mean, in an individual case, they might be very important, but relatively small issues remain that might be incorporated. I don't think that the Third Amendment has ever been incorporated against the states. But
the other ones are just procedural, but the Third Amendment, if a case arose, there was actually an allegation in a lawsuit that said that. It was back in the 60s when the National Guard was doing a lot of stuff and there were riots and everything, and somebody actually alleged that. And I think it was the Third Circuit Court of Appeals assumed that the Third Amendment would apply to the states.
It would. Well, I've always thought of the Third Amendment as being the very most effective amendment in history, because when is the last time you saw redcoats living in your
right,
bedroom?
Right.
So maybe we don't need to incorporate it. Everybody just assumes that it applies. Let's bring it again. I mean, this is all fascinating, Steve. We could talk all day, I can tell. But what is your message going to be tomorrow?
Well, I want to combine some things like history and also where the Supreme Court might be headed now, and the language of the Second Amendment, what's permissible, what's not. I mean, everybody, I think, is on the same page in the sense that we don't want bad people to have guns. And then the question becomes, well, how far can you go? And particularly, how far can you go in restricting law-abiding people? And those are issues that are being brought before the courts now, particularly on whether there's a right to carry a gun outside the home. We're in the state of Tennessee here. It's the same here as in almost all states. If you have good character, clean record, have some training, you can get a permit to carry a handgun for self-defense. There are a few states that you cannot, New Jersey, New York, California. In those states, it depends on who you are as to whether you get a permit. So if you're in New York City and you're like a multi-billionaire and you're really influential, you can get a permit. But if you're just somebody, some Joe Blow in Harlem in a high crime area, you're not going to get a permit. I mean, are you kidding me? So it's a question of fairness here as well as the Second Amendment. Fairness meaning due process, equal protection, things like that. But anyway, that's a case whether you really do have a right to bear arms. That's what the amendment says, you have a right to bear arms, but we don't think about restricting that to the home. That would be kind of bizarre language when you really have a right to keep in the home.
Right. Some states have moved in exactly the opposite direction, and they've become so permissive that there is no Second Amendment issue. I mean, they just keep making their laws more and more permissive. I'm not going to use the word liberal because it's typically considered a conservative thing, but more and more permissive. But other states, typically blue states, do still try to impose some sort of restrictions on gun ownership or gun carrying or licensure or whatever. And that's when the Second Amendment becomes an issue, because then the question is, can this state government do this particular thing that arguably infringes my or your Second Amendment right? And the Heller Court itself was very explicit. This does not mean, just because we have this right, it does not mean that regulations are all unconstitutional. Nothing in the law, nothing in the Constitution is absolute. So we're in that phase now where we're working our way through all of the dozens or hundreds of restrictions that are on the books there as people challenge them. And so look in your crystal ball. We are running out of time here. Look in your crystal ball and tell me what you see as the next few years in development in Second Amendment law.
Well, When you look at the justices, and this is reading the tea leaves, and this is hazardous,
right?
And it's something we probably shouldn't do, but I'm just going to...
Please, go ahead anyway.
you have to look at who the justices are on the Supreme Court and how they vote. And we know we have four who are adverse to the Second Amendment. I mean, Justice Ginsburg said that Heller was one of the worst decisions the court's ever made, and mm-hmm. she'd like to see it overturned. Justice Stevens said the same thing. He's retired now, but the replacements have voted adversely on this issue. But now we have new kids on the block in the Supreme Court. I mean, we've got the guys who have been there a while. Justice Thomas has been the most stalwart defender of the Second Amendment. Justice Scalia was, and he, of course, passed away. Justice Alito has been very strong on the issue. And now we've got Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, and they both wrote opinions when they were circuit court judges that were favorable to Second Amendment rights. The big question mark is the Chief Justice, Justice Roberts. Now, he voted with the majority in Heller and in McDonald. People try to speculate about where would he go on this, and some people criticize him because of his vote on the Obamacare decision, upholding that. But we really don't know. There's no way to know how any case is going to come out there. I gave up a long time ago trying to predict outcomes in cases. Even in lower courts, you think, man, I got the best case, and then you lose. And then you think, man, this is a tough case. I don't know if I'm going to win, and then you win. I don't know what the – I don't want to predict the outcome of any specific case, but I do think that this right to bear arms because of the language of the Second Amendment, that I don't see how you can restrict that to a few people that the government selects to exercise that right. And then the second major issue that you mentioned, blue versus red states, mm-hmm. States like California, New York, New Jersey, they ban what are most people in America consider to be ordinary rifles. They made up a pejorative term for them. They call them assault weapons. They're actually ordinary semi-automatic rifles of the type that you see on every shooting range in the country, other than in those states where they're banned. And so that's another issue, whether those laws violate the right to keep arms, and particularly the holding in the Heller case that the court said that you cannot ban handguns because they're the kinds of arms that are typically possessed for lawful purposes by law-abiding citizens. So mm-hmm. if you apply that test, most guns of the type that we're talking about that are available nationally aren't in the mold, that they're somehow like exclusively used by criminals.
Well, you don't want to look too deeply into your crystal ball, but we certainly have to remark that things have been moving your way. And that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are obviously Republican appointees, and they both have fairly conservative perspectives on a lot of issues, including the Second Amendment. So you're probably sitting pretty right now, and the big question mark is Chief Justice Roberts. So we'll wait until the next big Second Amendment case comes up, and we'll look for you, at least in the amicus briefs. Steve, thanks very much for your time. One more time, what is your website?
StephenHallbrook.com, StephenHallbrook. HALBROOK.com. And I should say I'm also a senior fellow with the Independent Institute. They've published my last two books, and we have a good relationship. So I just wanted to mention that as well.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Stuart. My little son.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And in case you're just joining us, I'll mention that we're talking about the Second Amendment this week. We've just finished a really interesting discussion with Steve Hallbrook of the Independent Institute. He was one of several speakers at a recent symposium on the Second Amendment held at my law school, the Duncan School of Law. And now we'll hear from another participant in that symposium. His name is Robert Spitzer.
I'm Distinguished Service Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at the State University of New York College at Cortland, where I have taught for getting close to 40 years.
Good heavens, you don't look that old.
Well, I was a child prodigy.
Were you a child prodigy? Yes.
They hired me when I was 12. I was a precocious lad.
I'm so glad, Bob, and I'm so glad that you could join us today, because you are a distinguished professor and you are quite an expert on a number of things, including the Second Amendment. And so we would like today to ask you why you're here for our symposium, I'm guessing?
Yes, that's right. I was invited to participate in the Second Amendment Symposium, which I was happy to do. I've attended various kinds of symposia on gun policy and Second Amendment at various institutions over many years. I've written 5 books on gun policy and a great many articles and op-eds on the subject of guns in America, political, legal, historical, and other elements to the larger gun debate. And it's a subject of great interest to me. And I'm actually one of the relatively few political scientists who has jumped into this subject matter with both feet.
Yeah, I'm actually more accustomed to dealing with law professors and lawyers. So why does a political scientist like yourself get into this very constitutional matter?
Well, it's part of my larger interest in the issue. The way I actually got involved in this is a pretty academic one, in the sense that I was contacted one day by a colleague way back in the 1980s who was putting together a book of readings on different controversial social policy issues like abortion and gay rights and women's rights and civil rights. And there was a chapter on gun control that nobody had claimed. And he asked if I wanted to do that or one of the chapters. And I said, well, gun control sounds interesting. And I researched the chapter. It included attention to the Second Amendment and the founding period and that history, which is of great interest to me. And I wrote the chapter and sort of had a aha moment where shortly after that I realized that there was no book on the politics of gun control, because like so many issues that we confront, the essence of understanding how this issue plays out in America revolves around political considerations. And I began researching this book, which became a book called The Politics of Gun Control. It includes a chapter on the Second Amendment. I later wrote a separate book on the Second Amendment, and I've updated The Politics of Gun Control in new editions, and it's now out in a 7th edition.
Well, then you must have sold a few copies. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to hear you say this, and I'm so pleased to have a political scientist here, because occasionally, not all the time, but occasionally, especially when I'm teaching an introductory constitutional law course, and it's a required course, it's a bar-tested subject, so everybody has to take it. So because it's that, you get everybody, and you don't necessarily get self-selecting students who are interested in the subject. So invariably, I will get a few comments on the student evaluations. Why do we waste so much time on history and politics? Why can't we just go to the black letter law? And I tell them flat out, you cannot understand really any law, but especially constitutional law, unless you understand the context, and that means history, and it means politics. So your involvement in this is not the least bit unnatural. It's welcome.
I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. I will say that historically, legal education, I have not attended law school. I'm not a lawyer. Let me stipulate that. But I've studied constitutional law, especially Second Amendment issues, and also Article II presidential powers in other work. But it's clear that there's always been a political dimension to constitutional law, to the functioning of the courts. And, we are now in the midst of a raging contemporary debate raised partly by President Trump, where he talked about and sort of said that the courts are all political, at least when they rule against him. And Chief Justice Roberts, to his credit, says, we're judges. We're here to evaluate the law. And that is the right attitude. But political science has been valuable in demonstrating that politics does play a role. And that, I think, is important to understand, simply because you need to understand the reality of how law functions to have a better sense of how the legal system works.
Absolutely. In fact, at the risk of sounding Trumpian or sounding cynical, I have sometimes said law, and especially constitutional law, is just politics written down, because law is the result of a political process. It's as a result of compromise. The Constitution itself is a political document and the result of compromise. On the other hand, the written down part means something. It means that now it's been crystallized, and now we all have to look at the same document, and we have to have someone to definitively interpret it, and those are called federal judges, and they have lifetime tenure, effectively. Precisely so, they can take themselves out of the political realm, as Chief Justice Roberts insists, and judge cases on their merits, rather than on whatever political ideology they might personally favor. So I think both sides in that perennial debate have a point. I mean, of course, law is political, but it's also law. It's not politics.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And I will just say there's an old anecdote from Justice Robert Jackson, who was
the best writer in the history of the Supreme Court. But go on, please.
A wonderful writer, and yes, who was Attorney General for Franklin Roosevelt, and who defended Roosevelt's seizure of steel plants and coal mines and other things during World War II. And when he was sitting on the Supreme Court in 1952, when the steel seizure case came along, when Harry Truman tries to seize a steel mill, and lawyers brought the argument before him that, look, when you were attorney general, you indeed defended this practice. And he ruled against Truman's seizure and said, look, you know, I cannot be bound by my essentially political activities. And I'm now a judge and I have to make this determination based on the merits of the law. And that was kind of illustrating that point.
In fact, Justice Jackson's concurrence in that case is often cited as the single most important part of the case. And I will simply direct people to it. We don't have time to talk about his theory of presidential power here. But that's a great anecdote because it really illustrates the difference between law on the one side and interpreting the law objectively as a judge, and politics, where a lawyer might, well, does represent one or a different side in a case, which is a different form of political argument. So, yeah, once you're on the bench, and this is why, by and large, I prefer the federal judiciary to the state judiciary system of appointing judges. There's a certain degree of elevation and insulation from the political storms that roil around us. So it'll be very interesting to see what Chief Justice Roberts does in the next few years.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week we're updating you on the Second Amendment, something that hasn't been in front of the Supreme Court for almost a decade. Recently, however, the court decided to take a new Second Amendment case out of New York City. So it's time for us to talk to several experts who recently came to a Second Amendment symposium at my law school, the Duncan School of Law. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're talking all about the Second Amendment. Earlier we heard from Steve Holbrook, a senior fellow at the Independent Institute. Now we're talking to Bob Spitzer of the State University of New York, and we're very specifically talking about what various justices on the Supreme Court may do with regard to the Second Amendment in the near future. And as used to be the case with Justice Kennedy, the old swing vote, all eyes are now on the Chief Justice, John Roberts. But there's lots of other stuff to talk about with regard to the Second Amendment, much of which Bob addressed at our symposium.
What are you going to tell us tomorrow?
Well, there are two sorts of things I'm going to talk about. The assignment I had was to kind of lay out my view of the Second Amendment as a law, as constitutional law, both respect to its origination, its evolution, and how it's interpreted today. And the other part of my talk is the second part will be related to that because, as I will discuss in my talk, the Second Amendment, which indeed says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And in fact, Supreme Court Justice Warren Burger from back in the 1970s once wrote, not in a decision, but in a magazine article, that the best way to understand that amendment is if you begin it with the word because, as in because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So it's an amendment that's all about militias and military concerns that arose from the 18th century and how America defended itself because it was profoundly suspicious of standing armies for good reason, especially because the American leaders knew their European history. And European and world history is littered with examples of nations where military forces simply overtook and overthrew civilian regimes. And of course, that happens in the modern era too. It happened in Pakistan not very long ago, for example. And so we relied heavily on the militias, but the militias had to be essentially it was sort of like an unfunded mandate in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. Militiamen were obliged by law, in fact, to have their own weaponry should they be called up for military service because the government didn't have the ability to arm militiamen should their service
right,
be
so
needed.
A bunch of farmers in Rhode Island or a bunch of farmers in Virginia were required to have a musket and powder and balls in case they were called to a muster to protect the colony against whatever threat the colony faced, because there was no standing army.
That's exactly right. Every colony had had measures like that. Every state had a law like that when we became the United States. And the U.S. Congress passed a law like that called the Militia Act in 1792. The only difficulty with these, with this federal and these state laws, is that they did not include an enforcement provision. And there was fierce debate about that when these laws were debated. And they just didn't want to include a mechanism in the law to make or penalize men who didn't abide by these laws. As a consequence, they were widely flouted and ignored because most men had other things to do. Nevertheless, it was this assurance to the states that, look, you'll be able to maintain your own state militias under this new constitutional system, remembering that militias were controlled by the states entirely before the new constitution. But the new constitution of 1787 gave that power to the Congress, to the federal government, and the states were frantic about this. What about us? What's going to happen to our militias? So the Second Amendment was their assurance that they would have the continued right to maintain their militias for military purposes as a counterbalance to possible abuse by a professional American standing army. And that is the understanding of the amendment that the people who wrote the amendment talked about. It's how the courts viewed the amendment in the 19th and into the 20th centuries, and a few Supreme Court decisions and dozens of lower federal court decisions until 2008.
And I'm guessing that you're not a big fan of Heller. But before we get there, you mentioned Chief Justice Burger, who was, he was no liberal. I mean, he was appointed by Richard Nixon to replace the very liberal Chief Justice Earl Warren, very explicitly to replace him and go in a different direction. And yet, I believe on one occasion, he said that anybody who claimed that the Second Amendment was protected an individual right to keep and bear arms was perpetrating a fraud.
Yeah, that's pretty much the exact quotation from Chief Justice Burger. And that's in line with the Supreme Court's own past decisions, with lower federal court decisions, which all took that approach. But this sort of other idea that the Second Amendment was designed historically to protect an individual or personal right of average citizens to have guns emerges, it gains traction. And eventually in 2008, the Supreme Court, in a famous and controversial decision, the case of D.C. versus Heller, rules by 5-4 vote that this amendment protects an individual right of average citizens to own a handgun for personal self-protection in the home. And my question, which I will get to in my talk, is, well, where exactly did this idea come from? And the answer is it came from it began as a serious argument in a law in 1860 by a law review student. And one of the things I did in past research was I examined every law review article on the Second Amendment written from the beginning of the Index of Legal Periodicals up through the year 2000. Hmm. And I spent time doing this research at a nearby law library, and I discovered that there were a total of 13 law review articles that had been published from the late 1800s up until 1959 that talked about the Second Amendment, and all of them analyzed it as a militia-based right, not a personal or individual right. But then this 1960 article comes along, and it, plus other energetic efforts by individual rights proponents, begin to publish in law reviews to sort of build a corpus of writing to expand and defend this idea of the Second Amendment as either including an individual right or that it is only about an individual right and not about militias at all. And
that's a pretty steep mountain to climb, though, isn't it? I mean, it starts out a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Well, my goodness. I mean, I remember when I first started hearing those arguments, I thought, how are they going to write out of existence that first clause? But I can see you nodding. So tell me, how did this happen?
Well, this takes you to the majority opinion, which brought together a number of these past writings that had appeared or thinking that had appeared in some prior law review articles. And the Justice Scalia, a very smart fellow, really had to engage in what I would say is a counterfactual view of how and why the Second Amendment was added to the Constitution. And frankly, he took considerable criticism from legal scholars of all ideological stripes, from Judge Posner in Chicago, a famous conservative jurist, and many others, who said essentially that the history is all wrong. And frankly, for my money, the history is all wrong. The reason Scalia chose this path is because Scalia is an originalist, or was an originalist. And he believed that, you know, that you needed to go back to the original writings and interpret them in the historical context at the time to understand any part of the Constitution. And that's certainly an important exercise. I wouldn't deny that for a minute. But the way...
But wait a second. An originalist normally would be very interested in accurate history to have the appropriate context to interpret the text. And what you're telling me is that Scalia, the self-avowed originalist, was basing his originalism in this case on, dare I say it, fake history.
Essentially, yes.
Oh, my.
Because there was writing that he was able to draw on. And indeed, I began the timeline in 1960. By the time you get to the 1980s, there's an explosion of this kind of writing. And then you have some law school faculty who are not conservatives who suddenly say, well, you know, this individual view, maybe it's something to it. I mean, their purpose was initially to create some degree of reasonable doubt about the standard view, to say that that the existing view was defective, that it missed parts of the history, and to make other courts of claims that essentially were raising reasonable doubt about the existing view, and then trying to elbow in this new view, and through the sheer quantity of writing by enough people, eventually it gained quite a bit of traction, I will say specifically among the conservative legal community, the Heritage Foundation, for example, the Federalist Society in the 1980s, which became very important, very mm-hmm. important. And of course, there have been a main funnel for judges to the federal courts and the Supreme Court. And so many of them accepted this argument, and they found 5 votes in 2008 to make it fly.
It's been said that Heller is the only decision of the U.S. Supreme Court written in Hebrew, that is, read from right to left rather than left to right, because people will say that Justice Scalia and his 4 justices who joined his opinion looked at the second part of the Second Amendment first. And then once they determined that second part, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, once they determined that that created an individual right, then they went back and did their analysis of what they then dismissed as the prefatory clause.
Right. Some linguistic games were played, partly by parsing the sentence, divorcing them in the way that you describe, and sort of what comes out of the decision is, well, there's something about militias in there, but it's only an example of the kind of activity that citizens might have engaged in with firearms in the 18th century, let's say.
Right.
It's a lengthy decision. It is a very historical decision in the sense that it talks a lot about history, although colonial historians and constitutional historians by and large decried the history and the quality of the history precisely because it is essentially a kind of counterfactual historical view. And I will make the point also in my talk tomorrow that it's too bad that Justice Scalia was so heavily wedded to the originalist point of view, because I think he would have made his argument much more effectively and logically by taking a living constitutional view. That is to say, look, circumstances have changed in 230 years, and maybe we're at a point now where we need something like an individual right of people to have firearms, and of course accepting that mm-hmm. You can have regulation of those firearms, and the decision went on to great length to detail kinds of laws that the court thought would be perfectly allowable, which
right.
really means pretty much most existing gun laws today are considered fine under the rubric of Heller. It certainly did not establish anything like an absolute or unqualified
yeah.
right.
Yeah, as you know, there's no such thing as an absolute right. And here's a funny anecdote of my own. I was once interviewed by a local newspaper in Southwest Virginia about the Second Amendment. And I made a statement in this public presentation that I thought was completely non-controversial. I said, well, you know, Second Amendment's not absolute, like any other law. And that was the headline in the paper the next day, because that's what people do. Politically, they've taken Heller and they've run with it, and they feel like they've got this absolute right. And even the court itself in Heller said the opposite. Okay, well, here's an interesting question, then, and I think I know where you're going to go with this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Given that Heller is widely condemned among historians and legal scholars, doesn't that create a weakness for the future? I mean, the court right now is moving further to the right, and it may continue to do so for a significant period of time. But you know, if you look forward decades from now, if you've got a doctrine of individual gun ownership that's built upon a shaky historical foundation, it seems to me that that might give an opening to a future court to go back and say that Heller was wrongly decided and therefore pretty much abandon that doctrine. The court does that periodically. It'll reverse course 180 degrees.
That's true, but I am inclined to think that that's unlikely to happen. And
even decades from now.
Yeah, partly because of the principle of stare decisis or stare decisis. I've never.
I didn't speak Latin either. Yeah. Let it be. You know, once you've got settled law, stick to it, right?
And there will surely, you know, there will be cases in the future, and the existing leanings of the court suggest that they will. They're certainly have no inclination to repeal, to roll back, to overturn the Heller decision. And it also is something that's in the Bill of Rights, even if you argue about the manner in which it's been interpreted for the modern era. And I think that there's a generalized, that there will tend to be a generalized reluctance to flatly overturn that right once it has been established. And even though you might argue that it's a right that's rather different from something like free speech, for example, it is still a right, and it's still mentioned in the Second Amendment, no matter the context, no matter the interpretation. And for the court to take away a right, having given it, granted it, and validated it in some manner decisions, I think that militates against the idea that it would simply be overturned. I think a more likely possibility, assuming that the judges hostile to Heller come along at a future time, in many, many years down the road, let's say, more likely is that it might be pared down, it might be restricted to a greater degree, you might have rulings that are more broadly accepting of limitations, of restrictions, and that would seem to me to be a more likely long-term prospect. But of course, as you know, it's always a hazardous business trying to predict what the courts will do.
It certainly is, and you're being remarkably prudent. It may not have gone to law school, Bob, but you sound like a lawyer.
Uh-oh. Better call my mother.
That's a compliment.
I appreciate that.
Well, Bob Spencer, thank you very kindly for coming in here and speaking with us today, and I'm sure you'll have a great time at our symposium tomorrow.
I'm looking forward to it and really enjoy speaking with you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to both of our guests, Steve Holbrook, the senior fellow at the Independent Institute, and Robert Spitzer, a professor at the State University of New York at Cortland. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.